Hey everybody, welcome to the 328th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a privacy-centric show for you today. We're going to be talking about the Amazon Echoes. We're going to be talking about Google and getting a lawsuit against its voice assistant. Microsoft shared some scary data, or at least surprising. And we've got some facial recognition news you'll want to hear about. Facebook is also trying to train robots for the smart home. ADT has got their legal hats back on and are suing Vivint again for patent infringement this time. And Brilliant brings HomeKit to its smart plugs and wall switches. And we should just do an update on Brilliant because why not? And Kevin tested out the Wyze lock and keypad and he's going to tell you what they think. Actually, what he thinks. He doesn't know what they think. And our guest this week is going to be Teppo Hemia, who is the CEO of Wirepass. We're going to be talking about a new standard for massive IoT. Just because we're really nice, we're also going to tell you what massive IoT is. Yay! And you'll hear from our sponsor, Silicon Labs, talking to us about their upcoming Works With conference. But before we get to any of that, we're going to hear from another one of our sponsors, Trek 10. Trek 10 is an AWS premier consulting partner. They have competencies in IoT, DevOps, and managed service focused 100% on the AWS cloud. They have years of experience integrating IoT devices with the AWS cloud, and they can do it from their new smart products to legacy old school industrial systems. Plus, they specialize in ensuing AWS best practices for security, scalability, and reliability. They'll support their clients in the analysis, the design, build, and even long-term support of their IoT ecosystems. So if you want to learn more, visit trek10.com/IoT. That's TREK10.com/IoT. All righty, Kevin. Okay, in today's non-news freakout over security and privacy and whatnot. Actually, this was this weekend's non-news, but it was discovered by researchers from Northeastern University that they could actually get data off of reset Amazon Echo devices.
Yeah, they did what researchers do, and they went and bought about 86 used Amazon Echo devices on eBay and at flea markets. And this, first of all, this actually isn't news, but it's a public service announcement. They found that 61% of those used Echo devices had not been reset, which the PSA is reset your smart home devices before you sell them, recycle them, or just stop using them and put them in a on a shelf somewhere. Oh my goodness, I can't believe that. That's just terrible.
Okay, wait. Stacy confession?
Oh no.
I just threw away my Wink Hub. That's right. I just threw away my Wink Hub. And I did not reset it because I hadn't had it plugged in for so long. And I was like, eh.
You didn't want to hook it up, spend the time. I get it, but.
So the moral here, I know, it felt, I was like, oh, I am doing a bad, bad thing. The moral here is if you are going to take your device offline, you should reset it like for any point in time. So now I do it because I like only put like my smart cameras out for vacations. Mm-hmm. So when I come back from vacation and I'm before I take them down, I actually hardware reset them. It's kind of a pain, but it's just I've learned over the years that I'm not going to plug it back in to reset it.
Right.
All right. So
right.
But I'm confessing so you know. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway, the bigger issue here that affects I think everybody who gets rid of smart devices, even if they do reset them, this is really bad. A lot of personal data, even on reset devices, is still stored on the NAND-based flash, according to the researchers. Now, I will say that they had to like sometimes desolder the flash memory and use other software and tools to get at that data, but that's neither here nor there to me because
I don't think this is a huge deal. This is the way NAND flash memory works. So to me, this feels like if we're going to talk about this as being a bad thing, we've got to talk about the fact that like when you delete your data from Facebook based on the way they've architected their systems and the fact that they use flash memory for some data, that you can never actually delete all of your data. Like, there's still the zeros and ones hanging out somewhere that have not been fully wiped.
That's fair. But in that particular example, I don't have control over that device where the data is stored on the flash. Here, I've got a physical device in hand with my data still on the flash. And I believe that it can actually be, like, the data can be removed, like, through wear leveling and all that.
Yeah, it can. And it includes your SSID and password, possibly.
Yeah. And your location, even. If you can set up the device using that old data, you can say, where's the nearest coffee shop? And it can kind of pinpoint where you are based on the old data. I don't like this.
Yeah, and so they also, like, checked out the recovered devices, they reassembled, and then they turned the device back on, and then they were able to actually get data from, they were actually able to ask the Echo questions. They spoofed the access point Echo was supposed to be on, and basically then, because it thought it was still in the old network, they could answer. It would answer questions like, who am I? And it would tell you the previous owner's
name. Previous owner, exactly. Exactly. I gotta believe that there's a technical solution for this, whether it's a firmware update from Amazon that could totally jiggle around those leftover bits and bytes. Will they do it? Probably not. And honestly, I don't mean to just harp on Amazon here. This is likely a similar situation with any other.
Yeah, this is a function of how NAND flash works and how people write and program to it. Because otherwise, you end up with those, you know, remember the Tesla is it EMC? EEMC error?
Anyway, EMMC. That is correct.
EMMC.
It wore out. Yes.
So this is a function of how they work, because you only have a limited reads and writes to flash memory before it's just not, it doesn't work anymore.
Right. But, and the researchers did say that, you know, why not have a data partition that is encrypted? So, I mean, I kind of figured all the data was encrypted on the device, on these devices.
Oh, really?
Locally, yes.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, let's talk about doing a TPM or a secure enclave and popping everything in there. Or maybe in a couple of years when ARM's confidential compute comes out, they can have a whole, you know, realm for that.
Yeah. I'm not saying people should panic. I'm not saying I'm panicked. I just don't like this, that the fact that this possibility exists. I mean, smart home devices people have trust issues already, and this doesn't help things.
That's fair. I will give it. See, I was like, oh, this feels kind of like a freak out overblown, but and it's a lot of trouble. I will say it's a lot of trouble to get to this data. But like, if you are I can't imagine like a spy. Like, if I'm imagining like the Americans set today, they probably don't have an Echo in their house.
No, probably not. Probably not.
But actually, how would they handle cell phones? I mean, those things are like walking microphones. Anyway.
They are, yes. Yeah.
Speaking of walking microphones.
Good one.
A U.S. District Court judge in California is allowing a proposed class action suit to go forward against Google and Alphabet based on the fact that they violated California privacy laws. And basically, the lawsuit says that people who accidentally trigger the voice-activated voice assistant on their smartphones, Google keeps those recordings and people don't have a way to like delete them or get rid of them. And they don't necessarily know what's happening. And Google may have transferred those conversations to other people. And basically, the issue is, I wasn't talking to you, Google, but you heard me and recorded me anyway.
And so this, like false positives of activating your voice assistant.
Yeah. And they also are saying that Google uses those conversations to target advertising against them. And that's not right.
No.
Google's defense is, hey, nobody was harmed.
Well, the quote that's in this story really irks me. Here it is. Google never promises that the assistant will activate only when plaintiffs intend it to.
Yeah.
Really?
See, this gets into the false positives. Every company knows they have them. And by golly, you should start publishing that. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I am under no illusions that my Echo device only responds to Madam May's name.
Right.
Because she pops up all the time with not just helpful suggestions, but, you know, or advertisements. She just pops up like, I'm sorry, I can't understand you. And I'm like,
but we've had to shut off our microphones on our smart devices when doing this show, not just because we're pretty careful about not saying the hot words, but even so, every once in a while, it will still think it heard one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Google's a little hard, I'll be honest.
It's hard. It happens. And in fairness, I will just for a second look at the other side of this coin. To use that data to try and reduce the false positives, that I have no problem with.
But targeted. And I agree. I didn't think Google was using it that way. That was one of the things I was a little confused about. But
have they actually proved that they have, though? I don't know.
That's the issue. So that's
right.
Basically, this is, hey, this can go forward. So we'll learn a lot more. Yay. Also, this is not false positives news, but this is, I found this not surprising, but the number was disturbing. So last week at a House committee, a Judiciary Committee meeting, Tom Burt, Microsoft's VP of Customer Security and Trust, testified that Microsoft gets 7 to 10 secrecy orders a day from the federal government. That's only a third of all the legal demands that Microsoft gets. That is bonkers. So that's like 30 requests from law enforcement a day, or 21 to 30 law enforcement requests a day. And that means the feds, police officers, they know that there's all this potentially incriminating, or at least interesting to them, data in your cloud or in the service provider's cloud.
Or even metadata.
Like, hey, where was this phone traveling from 2 to 5? Actually, that would be a nice request. Sometimes you get those geofence warrants where they're just like, show me all the available phones that were in this vicinity when this crime took place.
Mm-hmm.
These are a problem. And we need to start thinking about how, I think the horse is out of the barn. The genie's out of the bottle. We have got to figure out how we want law enforcement to use this. How does the Fourth Amendment apply to cloud data, to our digital footprints?
Yeah, I almost want to say, which is something you were saying there, it's almost too late, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, we've got to...
It's too late to say, hey, this data doesn't... Like, no one can have access to this data. Everyone knows the data's there. The data's going to get accessed. So then we have to say, look, do they need a full warrant? Because right now they've got to give, metadata, you only need a subpoena. If you want to actually seize the content on a computer, you need a warrant. But metadata is pretty valuable. So maybe we need metadata gets a warrant too?
I think it should, but that's just me.
I agree.
Legislator.
And we also, like PII, that's ridiculously archaic in today's world. So we've got to work on this. Anyway.
Yes.
I'm writing a story about it. I've been thinking a lot about this, y'all. We'll see. Hey, let's talk about facial recognition. In the further erosion of privacy category.
I wish we weren't going to do that, but this is bonkers. This is double bonkers, in my opinion. There's a company called AnyVision. It's a facial recognition firm, and it is working with school districts. And one in particular is this story is about the Santa Fe Independent School District in Texas did one week, pilot program with AnyVision's facial recognition. They uploaded 5,000 student photos for this. And in 1 week, they had a total of 164,000 detections, and they were boasting about this. Well, so was the school district, actually. They were able to even detect one student 1,100 times. Well, good for you. You've got a great solution. Wow, I'm blown away with how good it is, in a sense. I don't know how many cameras they used, but this is scary.
This is like, in this case, you're playing hooky. If you don't go into the school building, you're fine. But like, let's say you cut class to hang out with your friends.
Well, no, you're not fine because it's going to detect that you weren't detected. You're not here today.
That's true. It could just send, at any legit school, the fact that you're not in class should be noticed.
Yeah. When you have that kind of coverage and that kind of the broad amount of times you can place a student somewhere in the school in 1 week, you could create a heat map. You could
You know how often that student's in the bathroom, how long they're there.
Yes. You know. Oh, and then it's all time stamped. And if something happens in that bathroom, like maybe a firework is set off, you could falsely detect or accuse that student of being there at the time. So they must have done it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of hypotheticals that are not good, in my opinion.
And, you know, faces that aren't, like, they're basically logging all these faces, and it's unclear, and they're bragging about these students, but does AnyVision keep those student profiles only on that database, or does it share it with its other customers, which include retailers who are using it to track, like, shoplifters? It says that they keep their records for a month, but they do allow customers to run reverse image searches against that database. So, like, I could say, I could have a picture of Tommy from school, and if I have a month basically to load his photo in and see where he was every single moment of that month in cameras. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, they do have a privacy mode feature in the AnyVision application, so it will ignore all faces, not any watch list. So this is useful, again, as you said, stores that have, you know, are using this for shoplifters, looking for shoplifters before they actually shoplift. And apparently Macy's does use that according to this article. So you could ignore, you know, the people like me who don't shoplift and do a pre-crime look for somebody who's a known shoplifter, I guess.
But they say that they bought this because they had a school shooting and they wanted to prevent another one. I don't see how facial, like, I have actually been the recipient of press releases that are like, hey, we can detect when someone pulls out a gun and sound an alarm. That's very different than facial recognition. And here, I mean, it's not like, you know, there are a few cases where someone has been suspended from school. Maybe they're a threat, and like getting a notification the second they walk in the doors might help if someone's mm-hmm. paying attention to that system. But given false positives, I feel like that's going to be an iffy situation. But this is not something that protects against school shootings.
No, it's not preemptive. It's at best, it's going to let you determine quicker who was involved with the shooting.
Yeah. So I look at this and I'm like, this is just a surveillance society for kids in school. And
yes,
it's going to be, it's a violation of students' privacy. Again, we need to be talking about this. We need to have laws. The laws need to be more nuanced than ban facial recognition. They need to be prescriptive about how districts, how governments, how private companies can use this type of data. That is
yes.
It. Okay.
Real quick, one thing that's not addressed in this article, at least if it is, I certainly missed it. I would love to hear from parents in that school district what they thought about this.
Well, one was banned from campus for arguing with security. I wondered, actually. They were like, they've already detected some people. One was a drug dealer, so legit. Two was kicking off the brother of someone at his sister's graduation because the brother had been suspended. I'm like, less legit. And three was getting a parent off of school property because she had been forbidden to go there after an argument with the head of security. I was like, if it were me, I'd be arguing with the head of security about how stupid this is. And they would be like, get out. Mm. And then I would never be allowed back. And they would know.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of things that people might know, God, this show is so creepy this week.
What happens after a holiday weekend?
I guess so. Facebook is announcing they're working on something called embodied AI, which is basically AI for robots. I'm like, embodied AI. It's AI for things that exist in the real world.
Yeah, just call it what it is.
It's robots.
Yeah.
They call it Habitat 2.0. It's an upgrade on a simulation platform that lets researchers train robots in virtual environments. In this case, the virtual environment is your home. It wants to train robots to stock your fridge and take out the trash and probably not fold laundry because that's really hard. But yeah, they're basically doing this. This is all simulated. So they have robots in the Habitat simulated virtual environment. This is kind of like synthetic data in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's fake everything. And the hope is they will be able to teach these robots to perform chores. I've actually seen, like, NVIDIA has a robots lab actually in Seattle that has something very similar, except it's real. And it is hard to get robots to do this stuff. So good luck to you,
yeah,
Facebook.
I think most people, even if this was viable technology and was working really well, and it was less in the experimental and training phase, I think most people would probably not go for something like this in their home. But I do see tremendous opportunity for where folks are in assisted living homes and so on. There is a lot of things that could be accomplished by a robot as opposed to an individual, and let the individual focus, you know, the qualified nurses and so on, and the healthcare providers focus on those aspects as opposed to folding laundry and so on.
Sure. I will say one of the more interesting things that we don't think about when we start thinking about robots in the homes that I have now, it's the first thing I think about because it's kind of a fun thing, is like I talked to some designers who are building robots for hospitals. One of the big problems is robots can't open doorknobs, but a lot of the closets where they were going to like go get towels and things like that had doorknobs. So they had to get the robots to work properly. They had to change the doors to like the lever locks that the...
Well, the typical hospital lock, yeah.
Yeah.
So they had to, easier to open, yes.
Yeah. So they had to change those. They had to widen a lot of their doorways because the robot was built too wide. In the Toyota robot example, the Toyota's working on home robots as well, they actually discovered that their home robots worked fine in the U.S. for most parts. I mean, stairs were a problem, right? But they didn't work in Japan because Japanese houses are so small, so they had to like redesign a ceiling-mounted robot, like on a gantry. So it was really fascinating thinking about, we're like, oh, the hardest thing to do with a robot is to train it. But you actually have to think about the built environment for a lot of this stuff, and we're going to have to adapt that. So it's kind of fun.
I think they get past the stairs with drone jetpacks on robots.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I was like, or that crazy, it's not Spot. I don't know if Spot, Boston Dynamics Spot can climb stairs, but that
I'm not having that in my house, thank you.
It can open doorknobs.
Cool. I think it's cool, but no, it's not coming in my house. Spot, stay outside.
Yeah. All right. Little bits of news. ADT is suing Vivint. Again, God, these guys sue each other all the time. This time, ADT is claiming Vivint's home security monitoring and automation control panels infringe on patents ADT has for smart home integration, data collection, and control panel functions and interfaces. Yeah, go to town. I mean, jeez. They really do sue each other all the time. They sue each other for sales practices, trademark infringement. Vivint's like, you know what? We're fighting these. These are completely without merit, blah, blah, blah. Just so you know, ADT just finished settling a lawsuit against Ring, saying it copied its blue octagon. Ring is now changing its shape. The Vivint complaint was filed in two places. One is the U.S. International Trade Commission, and a lawsuit was also filed in federal court in Waco, Texas. And the reason they wanted to do the IATC is because the ITC can halt imports.
Yeah,
and the ITC.
I was just going to say they want to stop sales.
Yeah, and the ITC is way faster than the U.S. federal court system.
Mm-hmm.
So, yay. All right, I don't care. I really don't. I'm like, lawsuits.
I know. I wish they would spend their money on R&D and make better products and let us choose instead of having these lawsuits to try and stifle each other. But that's just me.
Yeah, dude, just embrace matter and forget this stuff.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Brilliant, which I've used once before. And you've used the Brilliant.
Yeah, I had a bad time with the original Brilliant. But
I remember.
I hear it's better now.
Yeah, it wasn't so brilliant the first time around. I do remember that. But so you may not care about this. I kind of do, even though I don't have any Brilliant light switches or smart plugs. They have a firmware update to add HomeKit support in the smart plug and in-wall switch. And for those not familiar, these in-wall switches have a display screen, a motion sensor, slidable touch controls for dimming and such.
They're very fancy. They're like a iPad in your wall. They integrate with a lot of stuff. It's actually a very sleek system.
It is. It is. So for those who have these or are thinking about getting them, but were like, oh, it doesn't work with HomeKit, these do.
Yeah, it does.
Or will. Yeah.
So, yay. Oh, but the motion sensor in it will not be integrated with HomeKit just yet.
Not just yet. It seems kind of odd to me. That might as well roll it all out together, but okay. But that's them.
I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And let's talk about Wyze something or others. Locks this time.
Yes. Yeah. It's not a new product. We typically have a new Wyze product every few weeks. No, this is the Wyze Smart Lock and Keypad, which Wyze had sent me for review. I have already said I'm waiting for a thread-based smart lock. So what do you figure, at least 6 months I'll be waiting?
Yeah, I think you'll have to wait till next, maybe next spring.
Okay, I can do that.
I feel like we'll see stuff at CES and then it'll arrive in the spring.
That sounds fair. That sounds fair. So this was a review unit, as I said. What's interesting to me is that the Wyze Smart Lock, they take the August lock approach where you use your existing deadbolt and key on the outside, and then you have a basically a smart motor that turns, opens, and closes the deadbolt for you. It's so nobody outside knows you have a smart lock, but you do. It's kind of nice. It's rather inexpensive by comparison to other smart locks as well. It's, let me give you the weird pricing, $107.98, which I think is
that's cheap.
Yeah.
Inexpensive.
Yes. And it doesn't look cheap. I like the look. It's very modern to me. Again, I'm the only one that sees it.
It's a little blocky, but yeah.
That's okay. I can live with that. They sent me that. They also sent me the $24.98 Bluetooth keypad because I use a Nest by Yale lock, which has an integrated keypad, number keypad. That's why I never carry keys. I just use my keypad if I don't have my phone on me or something like that. So I like having that keypad. Overall, I think it works pretty well. I had a couple of glitches that I'll get to in a minute. Installation, very simple because you're using the existing deadbolt that you already have. You're just taking the back piece off with the turner handle. What do we call it?
Oh man, I forget now.
The release? I don't know.
Turner. It's something about a turner. A deadbolt turner?
I don't know. Yeah, deadbolt turner. We'll go with that. So this includes a deadbolt turner, a motor. They include four batteries inside. 15 minutes for my installation, as well as to pair it up with my smart home. The lock has Bluetooth and Zigbee radios inside. So that means to get connected to a home network, you have to use the little plug-in Wyze Lock Gateway, which is small. You know, it plugs into an outlet. And I'm not going to complain about it too much because my Nest by Yale has one too. Same thing. That's got Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and Zigbee. And so you pair it to that. And that's the communication bridge for the smart lock to your wireless network. And I had no pairing issues. And again, 15 minutes from beginning to end to install and pair. So that was good. I will say it is super quiet. Compared to what I have right now, which is a two-year-old smart lock, very quiet. Like I can hear the other one from like three rooms away. This one, pretty much the same room I can hear, and that's about it. So that's a plus.
Yeah, your family hated that.
Oh, they can't stand that. You know. And it sets the dog off too, because he can hear somebody coming in from anywhere, you know, in the house, but not with us. So it's got most of the features you would expect in a smart lock. You can configure it to automatically lock after X number of minutes, which, to be honest, I had to set up an automation in my Nest by Yale to do that, like a third-party automation. And that's, you know, that wasn't cool. Like, it's built in here, which is nice. The auto lock feature, this is a different auto lock feature. It supposedly can sense when you've unlocked, come into the house, and shut the door. And it should automatically lock right behind you if you turn auto lock on. I had it on. It never worked. So the timer handles that. So that's not a big deal. But the auto unlock feature I wanted to try because it uses both geofencing with your phone's GPS and Bluetooth to say, okay, you're in the geofence area. So now Bluetooth, am I close enough to the lock to unlock? I like this because I don't like geofencing because sometimes I walk and I can be a couple hundred feet from my house and geofencing will unlock a lock and I can't even see my front door from where that is. So that's not cool. So I'm like,
sorry, that's not cool.
well, especially because I have a end unit townhouse and yes, my front door is on the side. So I can't even see it when I walk up to the house. So somebody could just be waiting there like, Kevin went for a walk. Let's wait till he gets back close enough and we'll just hop in the house. Well, this addresses that because it says, and then when you get close enough to the lock and it sees the lock on your phone through Bluetooth, then it knows you're in the geofence and you're close enough. It couldn't get it to work. And I checked my location settings, always on, et cetera, et cetera. So I did something I don't normally do when I write reviews. I went and read other reviews. And specifically, I went to the Wyze site to actual customer reviews. And a lot of people reported the same thing. So I don't know if something can be updated in firmware or what, but it's just not working for me. So if you want that, this doesn't work reliably in my experience. So
or apparently in others.
Apparently in others, yes. Don't take my word for it. Take theirs. Voice control, it integrates with both Google and Amazon. It works for both of them. And just like my Nest Lock, if I want to voice unlock the door, it does ask me for a PIN, which I had pre-set up in that integration to know that it's me requesting that. Not anybody can just shout, please unlock the door, Google, and, you know, just have it unlock. So that's good. That worked perfectly fine. Automations, you can do that through the app. You're limited to Wyze devices, though, with the integrations. So I set one up. It works. I was even able to set it to only work during a certain time, like at nighttime. So when I walk into the house, turn on some Wyze bulbs after 7 p.m., but before 6 a.m., if that's what happens. So it doesn't happen in the daytime. That works fine, but you're limited to the Wyze devices. So that's not new. That's the Wyze ecosystem. So.
Yeah. And Wyze is a member of the Matter organization.
Ooh.
But, you know, I've talked to
their head of
product is like, we don't know what devices, they don't know what devices they're going to support yet.
It's fair. Not everybody has come forward with their plans. I'm not going to mention names. So that's fine.
Amazon.
So yeah. And then the keypad, that's key to me. No pun intended, because again, I walk outside the house without a phone. I just take long walks to clear my head. And, you know, I want to be able to press numbers to get in my house.
Oh, you have an iPhone. Does it work with your smartwatch?
There is no smart Apple Watch app for Wyze. I checked that because I thought that would do the trick, but no.
Okay. And now Wyze makes a band that I think it did work with their stuff, but
I believe so.
That's basically like a $20 key that you've got to wear around your wrist all the time. Eek.
That's fine.
No, you hated that device.
Yes, but people correctly called me out and said, look, it does what I want for $20.
Okay.
So fine. That's fine. It's not for me. It's for them. And that's fine.
All right.
For me, an Apple Watch suits my needs better. But I can't use this app on my watch. So that's why there's the very basic looking, but also similarly blocky, modern looking keypad. All the digits from 0 to 9, a lock button and unlock button. It's backlit. It uses Bluetooth, so it just connects to the lock directly. Works fine. You know, I was able to unlock my door, lock my door, and I walk out by using the keypad. I will say this. Normally, that I said the original prices, but normally those are separate items. For what it's worth, if you want a Wyze lock, they are including the keypad for free right now. So you can actually get the whole thing for $107.98, including shipping. So I was more impressed than I expected for the price.
Okay.
There's quite a bit of functionality here. Some people don't care about geofencing. Some people don't care that it doesn't work with an Apple Watch. That's fine. And if you're okay with that and you don't mind a little Wi-Fi plug-in taking up another outlet in your house, that's fine. Doesn't have Thread. So for me and for other reasons, it's not something I would buy, but I could see many people as their first smart lock be very happy with this. And if you're in on the Wyze ecosystem, you know, sure.
Meh. All right, moving right along.
Stacey gives that a real confident meh.
I mean, yeah. Okay, now it is time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline, which is the segment of the show where we answer your questions about, well, really anything that you want to ask us. This week's hotline is brought to you by Very, a fully distributed IoT engineering firm. Very is here to help you get your biggest IoT projects fully operational on time and on budget. You can discover what Very's multidisciplinary teams can do for you at www.verypossible.com. Okay. And if you would like to call us, you can reach us at 512-623-7424. And when you do, you'll be entered to win something. Did we decide what this month's prize was?
You were doing a grab bag of
right.
some things.
Grab bag.
A cornucopia
yeah,
of connected devices.
So I've got an Arlo doorbell in here. I've got a Wyze smart plug. Every week, I'm just throwing something else in here. So get excited. And call us at 512-623-7424. So this week's voicemail is actually, I think, a really good one. And
it is.
It is from Chris. So let's hear it.
Hi, Stacey and Kevin. I was just wondering if Amazon Sidewalk Network is now live. And since it uses LoRa and Bluetooth, are there any options for DIY development? Can I make any long-range sensors with an Arduino or Raspberry Pi that would use the network? And if not, are there any commercial devices that use it yet, or when can we expect those? That's it. Thanks for the podcast. Bye.
Okay, Chris. The good news is the Amazon Sidewalk Network has been live since June 8th is when it was turned on. So it's been live now for about a month. And there are products you can buy, but they consist of tiles stuff and a level lock. There aren't any DIY things yet. And Amazon is not, it's not a fully open, generally available developer platform yet. Amazon has it in a preview mode, basically, that you apply to get the information. I applied before it even launched and have not heard back from them, which makes sense because they're probably not prioritizing me because I'm not an active Amazon developer.
No sidewalk.
No sidewalk for you, Stacey.
Come back 1 year.
Your single sensors that you have tried, not given us any sort of excitement about you. So you can sign up. We'll include a link in the show notes. But we also went, because this is going to be an eventual open platform for developers to use, we went to the Sidewalk Developer Services program requirements. And these are basically Amazon's terms and conditions for developers who want to use the network. And they have them for...
These are the rules.
Yeah.
And it's a long list of rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's not terrible.
It's fairly boilerplate, but...
Yeah. I mean, it's things like, hey, don't market Sidewalk if the area you're selling your product in doesn't have Sidewalk. That makes sense. They did say that you can't charge subscription fees for Sidewalk, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if that means, though, you could charge, well, I was going to say maybe just for whatever service you're using over Sidewalk.
So Sidewalk's, I mean, Amazon does charge for access to Sidewalk. It's not a huge amount. It's like 2.3 cents per 1,000 messages. I can't remember.
It's minuscule. You know, I mean, if you scale, obviously it would add up, but it's not.
Yeah, it's a tiny, you could totally be like, hey, I'm gonna have this device that updates. You could easily set a price. You could say, hey, this device is going to update once every hour, 365, 24/7, and be able to price, and I'm going to support this for 3 years. So you could say you get 3 years of service with this device and be able to build that into your BOM, and it's not a significant cost.
And by BOM, you mean bill of materials.
Yes, bad Stacy. Using the jargon. So I think this is actually a smart thing to do because I think a lot of people are interested in sensors without subscriptions, right? So if I could just buy a product and it connects, great. And that is what Amazon's interested too. They want that as well. They want to build that infrastructure. So that's why Sidewalk even exists. Okay. Some other things that were notable, I'm very glad to see that Amazon has thought about security. So you've got to have it in there. You have to let Amazon know if your cryptographic keys are stolen. You have to ensure that the product firmware is updated for any known security vulnerabilities. So you can't just like...
And your device has to be able to accept firmware updates, I believe, over
yes.
the air even.
So you have to have... You basically have to pay attention to security on an ongoing basis, which... Feels like it should be the bare minimum, but I'm glad it's in there. And, you know, this is part of other Amazon, like the Madam A developer guidelines as well. They don't want crappy products selling their Madam A brand or their Sidewalk brand, as it were. I thought this was fun. In the branding requirements, which is surprisingly small, there's only one real thing, is you can't use the Sidewalk Echo, Amazon Ring, or Madam A name, or any other logos. And you can't have a light ring that is, quote, confusingly similar to Amazon devices.
Mm.
So you know how ADT is trying to do the blue octagon? I'm looking at this. I'm looking at Amazon. And I'm like, are you doing the, like, glowing light ring? Is that your blue octagon?
That seems weird to even have in there because people... They're not going to make voice assistant speakers and such that need to show you when something's listening. These should be like edge sensors.
Well, I guess you could have it to indicate that it's like connected, like how the strength of the signal strength that it's getting. You could use circles for all kinds of things. I mean, look at the iPod.
They're covering their bases, and that's the long and short of it. And I get that, but that just seems an odd thing to put in there to me. But
so anyway, Chris, sign up, check out these rules, see if there's something you want to abide by.
And make something cool and tell us about
well,
it.
Well, I'm going to say, look, I feel like the DIY stuff is going to be out later. You also asked Chris when this is going to be out. I think Amazon does have an event 2 weeks from now, Madam A developer event. I don't think we're going to get a lot of stuff here on that. I think you'll probably next year get a more open possibly GA version of Sidewalk, like the beginning of next year.
Yeah, in fairness, they did just launch, as you said. They went live about a month ago, and they've got their own products that they're still working on for integration. So it's early yet, but I'm glad people are thinking about what can I do with this network
now. I am so excited. Please get your sensors lined up and ready, folks.
So approve Stacy for the program.
Yay. All right. Well, that concludes the Internet of Things podcast hotline. Remember, if you would like to call us and be entered to win, you can just reach us at 512-623-7424. And now, stay tuned for our guest, Teppo Hemia, who is the CEO of Wirepass. He's going to be explaining what the heck massive IoT is and what the heck Wirepass has to do with 5G. We're also going to hear from another one of our sponsors. Stay tuned. This week's sponsor is Silicon Labs. Hey, everyone. We are taking a break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Silicon Labs, and I would love to welcome Ross Sabalsik, who is VP and General Manager of Industrial and Commercial IoT Products at Silicon Labs. Today, Ross is here to talk to us about WorksWith, Silicon Labs' virtual conference coming up in mid-September. Hello, Ross.
Hey, Stacy. How are you today?
Excellent. So, for those who don't know Silicon Labs, please just tell us a little bit about it.
So, Silicon Labs, we're a provider of wireless connectivity for a wide range of IoT applications. And that would extend everything from building a personal area network to connect your phone to something with Bluetooth, to an application where you might need multi-kilometers of range with a low power wide area network. So we have a complete wireless portfolio for all of our customers' IoT needs.
Awesome. And y'all are hosting WorksWith. This is the second year y'all are going to host this event. And can you tell us what it is you want to do and what makes the event unique?
We're uniquely positioned because we're really the only company out there that offers a complete portfolio of wireless connectivity for all applications from personal area networks up through LPWAN. In addition, we're working with the major vendors and customers who are shaping the future of the IoT. And you can come and hear tracks where they're going to show what their vision is for the future and what they're doing to unlock it.
And last year, y'all really focused on the smart home market. But this year, the event is expanding to include tracks for the smart city, industrial IoT, and general IoT. Can you give us a preview of what to expect from the smart city and industrial tracks?
Yeah, smart city and industrial IoT are two of the most exciting aspects of IoT. And we're going to have tracks that cover a wide range of applications, covering everything from commercial lighting, building automation, heating and air conditioning, all the way up through citywide applications like smart metering, asset tracking, and energy management.
I know I will be at WorksWith, but who else should attend?
WorksWith is really for everyone that's in the IoT industry, but in particular, software and hardware engineers, product managers, and business leaders will find tracks that are customized to aspects that will be interesting to them across a wide range of verticals and applications.
And where can I go to find out how to attend and to register?
Great. So registration is open online. You can register at workswith.scilabs.com. Once again, registration is completely free this year, and the event will run from September 14th through September 15th.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Teppo Hemia, who is the CEO of Wirepass. Hello, Teppo.
Hello, Stacey. Thanks for having me, and great to be here talking with you.
Yes, I am really excited. I feel like I've talked to you a bunch. I've talked to some of your customers, and I thought, you know, it's time to have him on the show to explain a couple concepts to people because, well, I think this, we'll talk about it. It's an exciting time for what we call massive IoT. So first off, let's very briefly tell people what Wirepass is doing.
Yeah, so Wirepass is a Finnish company. We focus on wireless connectivity. The offering itself, we have introduced first in the world this fully decentralized networking approach, which is especially focusing on this Internet of Things, massive IoT, as we studied.
Okay. And you guys aren't making the physical radios. You make the software that people then build radios using. And it's this distributed mesh network that is pretty low power. And you can fit a lot of radios in one space. I'm very impressed with how scalable this is. So we'll talk a little bit about all of that. But let's first talk about this concept of massive IoT, because I've been talking to Ericsson for a while and they started using it. And I was like, hold up. What is this? And they're just like, a lot of sensors. And I think we could probably do better. So when we talk about this, what does this concept really entail?
Yeah. So in our view, massive IoT has been the right vision and kind of a right promise for a good time. But it really boils down to the affordability. So when the cost of connection is clearly lower than the value of the data that you are getting with that connection, then you start to really see a massive growth and scale opportunities. The interesting thing with whole massive IoT is that it's not it's very difficult to put it with one use case or one vertical or so. It's really everywhere.
Yeah, no, it's definitely what I think of as classic infrastructure. And I feel like you're dancing around a little, so I'm going to make you spell it out a little bit more. The idea is really cheap connectivity. Is there a meshing? Does it need to be decentralized? How cheap? How much low power?
So, like if we compare, for example, to the cellular. Cellular was built in a way that with that concept, you built the indoor coverage from the outdoor. So you build it from outside in. While the mesh does it kind of from the opposite direction. So in this way of doing, every node is a base station. You don't need to think about densifying base stations to go to small cells, picocells, nanocells, because every node is a base station. Good example is that when we approach this 5G standardization, and when, there is now this independent evaluation group results available, one example there is that they did prove that the same organization of devices connected can be achieved with 4% of the output power per device versus the cellular way of doing. And that gives you already the idea that this is really disruptive way of getting the cost down. And that's why by doing it this differently, where every node is making all the network level decisions instead of one central place, you can, deploy it without an infrastructure. You can, scale it without, limits. And as you heard in the previous discussions, we can put even 1,000 radios in the cube meter. So those are the few proof points.
Got it. And this is something that we're hearing a lot more about right now. I'm thinking of things like Amazon Sidewalk Network, which they've launched on their devices and some other devices to create a very low-cost mesh network for the IoT, also decentralized. We've got things like Helium's network. We've got, some of the LoRaWAN networks are a little bit more centralized, so I'm not going to throw them in here. But even things like Apple's AirTags. So we're seeing a lot that kind of falls into this. Can you help orient what y'all are doing with things like that?
Yeah, so those are interesting concepts because they are kind of you could think of them a little bit as opportunistic networks because, they take benefit of, for example, iPhones for the AirTags to connect to the internet. But these are still very simple connectivity approaches. So it's basically beaconing. It's still different because what we have done here is that every node is an access point. So if we compare to Apple AirTag, the AirTag itself is also a router. So we really take the next level of connectivity, like the last mile connectivity. And for that reason, we are not positioning ourselves against the other wireless technologies, but we are rather complementing them. Cellular is obviously a great achievement and one of the biggest engineering investments in this world. But it was not designed for this small, tiny, endless amount of sensors and actuators type of a job.
And so in your envisioning, your network topology is, are there gateways? Are there no gateways?
Yes. So you need at least one gateway to start with. But you can think of that gateway if it's, for example, with cellular backhaul, it's kind of where the cellular ends. You know, it has a cellular radio, and then it has the mesh radio that then is towards to the mesh network. And that's the minimum infrastructure you need to put. But beyond that, every node in the network is an access point and router to other nodes. And they can locally then optimize based on the local radio environment, you know, the output power, the frequency to use or channel to use, when they are talking, when they are listening, to optimize the power and so on. And then when you grow as a network, you can add more gateways to build more capacity between the mesh and the internet. And that's the beauty of this concept, that you can just add on end devices and gateways without a limit. And typically people are using, you know, from 100 to 1,000 ratio between the end nodes and the gateways. And even if you lose a gateway, it's really not a problem because the algorithms reroute to the remaining gateways and balance the load among the remaining gateways. So it's like unbreakable.
I don't know if it's totally unbreakable, but yes. Like, I feel like people might try you there, Temple. Okay, so let's talk about why we want this. You have some really fascinating customers, and I would love to hear some of the story. I mean, like, one of my favorites is the company doing bedbug detection using your radios. After this, y'all, we're going to dig into some deep standard stuff. You want to stick around, but I'm trying to help y'all by letting you know why you want to know about this. So let's talk about how people are using this.
Yeah, so maybe I can give a couple examples. Schaeffler, you know, the world-leading ball bearing company, wanted to grow for digital services and build condition monitoring platform. And of course, they as a company being tens of years in that business knows exactly how ball bearing behaves and how you interpret the vibrations and other things, you know, when before they get broken. So basically they had most of those things before, but they used wired or you know, more expensive connectivity technologies. When the cost of connectivity is that high, that is wired or Wi-Fi or cellular, what you end up to do is that you connect maybe 5% of the motors in your factory. Now, when the affordability is taken to a new level, when the power is lower, you can have battery operated, no wires, more simple radios, very easy to deploy. Also private networks, you can decide whether you want to store the data locally in the factory. After all that, it's a no-brainer to connect all the motors, all the conveyor belts. Anything that, you know, moves or rotates can now be connected affordably. And this is really what the massive IoT is about. Well, the next example could be, for example, or can be taken from the hospital area. So we have UMC, the University Hospital in the Netherlands, who demonstrated that by connecting wheelchairs, hospital equipments, nurses, maybe even patients, they can find 10 to 20% efficiency improvements, because a lot of time is spent to try to, you know, find those equipments and having right things in the right place. And again, it's a similar thing that was in the factory, that how you can affordably connect mobile assets and also trace them. And that's very important. So not only connectivity is in our portfolio an important element, but it's also the ability to extract the location information out of this mesh network and get it actually as a kind of a free lunch, if you like, because the network itself does some signaling, which helps you to determine the signal strengths of different links, and by that then extract the location of different assets.
I feel like I still, you know, many of the use cases are like, hey, we're going to do asset tracking or cold chain management or predictive maintenance. And all of these are lovely. I'm not dissing them. But I do feel like there's a huge long tail of opportunities that I'm hoping we'll see as platforms like yours, like Sidewalk, and all develop. I guess, when do you think that might be? Is that like a 3 to 5 years from now kind of timeline?
Well, I think that the in terms of demand and in terms of investment starting, I think the pandemic did a big impact. It's accelerating many projects now. That's what we are seeing. And, you know, every company should make their own assessment what they could do better by remote monitoring, by knowing where their assets are, improving their processes and so forth. So I think it's already coming to a reality, but I think we shouldn't expect kind of a something omnipresent everywhere type of a kind of a service around IoT, because still the needs are quite diverse. And we are not saying that our technology fits to everything, but now with these two type of a product that we are having, Massive and the private 5G, we are extending the coverage a lot. Also, that is helping because with one investment, people can do a lot more, ranging from this super low cost, like disposable tags, to very sophisticated, you know, latest generations of smart meters in electricity, for example. So it's really there, but I think industrial and consumer side of the business will still be a little bit different, because the industrial side, no one can afford high deployment costs, because it's really the labor that makes a big difference when you try to deploy IoT systems. And if they are complex to do, it easily ruins your business case.
That makes sense. Okay. Now, let's get into the standards and what's actually very exciting, which is the radio technology that y'all have, which is called DECT 2020 NR. NR stands for new radio. So that's a lot of, like, I don't want to call it jargon. It's just a lot of letters and numbers stuck together. But we've talked about what this enables earlier on. You know, we talked about it. You know, every individual node has routing capabilities. It's highly distributed. I'm not going to call it infinite capacity. You can't, but I won't. I'm like, I feel like there's a limit somewhere.
Only 4 billion in one network.
Okay. So we've got a lot of positives here, and now it is part of the 5G standard. But it's not part of the 5G standard we all know and love by, like, the 3GPP 5G standard. It is part of the ITU standard. So, Teppo, help us understand what the heck is happening and what it really means for people at the end of the day.
Yeah, so first of all, there is this kind of a misunderstanding, if you like, that 5G equals 3GPP. But in fact, 5G is kind of a nickname for the IMT 2020, which is part of the ITU-R. Sorry for all the acronyms. Yeah, so it's an organization under the, you know, UN that governs all the radio standardizations at the highest level. Now, the 5G is, I mean, all the Gs, you know, 3G, 4G, 5Gs, used to be defined pretty largely by the 3GPP camp, which is obviously, you know, the equipment makers, operators, radio providers. Now, it actually doesn't mean that somebody else couldn't propose, contribute, and submit things to that standardization. And that is what ETSI did here. So ETSI is the European Telecommunications Standardization Institute, and this DECT was already there, as you may remember it, as a digital cordless phone. But we then, you know, joined that group in ETSI, and we started to discuss that what could be the, you know, the future of that standard, and we found the common view quite quickly, and then we had this great opportunity to contribute all the meshing aspects into that new standard. And, you know, it was great opportunity to first time really think that what IoT needs and build it from the ground up. So we already had built the products, but we didn't take that as it is, because we saw that there's actually even better physical layer opportunities, so radio options, and those were taken more from the cellular side, like OFDM, HARC, which are super robust link layer technologies. And then we put these meshing aspects on top of it. And that combination became very, very powerful. And ETSI did submit that to IMT 2020, which is another name, 5G. And maybe it was a little bit surprise, to be honest, to some players there. So how come something from so different origin can do this job so differently? versus what the cellular way of doing has resulted so far. But it was not a really surprise for us because basically we are coming from the highest density super scale corner of the whole wireless spectrum, if you like. So for us, it was just a way to prove that, hey, this way of doing can with major margin fulfill the requirements of MMTC, massive machine type of communication, of 5G, that 5G actually didn't much contribute. It's still largely 4G technologies on that particular corner.
So what does this mean for the cellular carriers, for people who are investing in 5G? Is the goal that one day you'll have a massive IoT component to like a carrier's 5G infrastructure?
That could be the long-term evolution. You know, this could merge and join with 3GPP parts of the standard. That's one route. Today, it is not connected to that. So even when this is complete, and we call it today non-cellular 5G for that reason, that these devices doesn't talk to the cellular base stations, but it is 5G as it fulfills the requirements that ITUR did set for 5G in the beginning. Now, what it means for telcos and what it means for enterprises is very interesting because, as you know, there is a big transformation ongoing towards more and more private networks into the enterprises. And we see that this is a great fit in that development as well. This type of a network can be set up by anybody in any place at any time. And thanks to this connection with the DECT standard, it inherits also this 1.9 gigahertz free-to-operate frequency band, which is a huge benefit for enterprises that they don't need to locally play with leasing spectrum or dealing with operators. Then what it means for the operators is actually up to the operators. We know in some discussions, some of the operators are quite keen to also look this part of the technology or 5G play because they realize that enterprises have a needs for all the three corners of that 5G triangle, meaning high bandwidth, low latency, and massive scale. So it's also for them better to be able to, you know, serve all those corners towards enterprises. Then there are some other telcos who might be more, you know, reserved or seeing this against their existing or current business model.
Got it. Okay. And then what is the process on this? When would we see this actually deployed?
From the standardization standpoint, we are in a moment where the final independent evaluation group results are becoming ready. There is now given still a month or so for some more data from the independent evaluation groups. But at least what we can say based on what great number of universities and great number of wireless research institutes and also companies proving that this really works. And the final inclusion to the 5G happens then October this year. And then it's officially part of the 5G. In terms of products, we are right now developing that first release and we are launching that next year. We come with the more accurate timelines probably in the fall time when we have progressed a bit further with our partners.
Okay, super early. Well, I am looking forward to our future IoT where connectivity is simpler, cheaper, and maybe embedded in more places than I can even imagine. And Teppo, thank you so much for coming on the show this week.
Thank you, Stacey. It was a pleasure. It's exciting times, and it's great to see all the different use cases coming up.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.